Good day to all of our ILTA listeners. Thank you for joining this podcast brought to you by the Litigation Support Peer Group. I'm Tom Bars from Fulbright & Jaworski, and I want to welcome you to today's podcast about legal hurdles in the cloud. As the buzz around software and infrastructure as a service has increased, so too have the concerns regarding the legal implications, not the least of which is e-discovery. So, in our search for expertise in this area, we have come to Eric Blank. He's going to provide an overview of what the cloud is and walk our listeners through the legal and e-discovery issues raised by cloud computing. Eric is a frequent author and speaker on the subject of e-discovery and computer forensics. He's the founder of and managing attorney of Blank Law and Technology, an information security law firm based in Seattle, Washington. Mr. Blank's practice focuses on developing strategies to effectively manage risks related to computer software and private and public networks, including the Internet. He regularly acts as an expert, neutral party, or special master on behalf of corporations, governments, and courts dealing with electronic discovery. Along with other attorneys, staff engineers, and technicians in his firm, Mr. Blank provides electronic discovery support services, including assessment, extraction, analysis, review, and production. Prior to founding Blank Law, Eric was a shareholder in the Seattle law firm of Riddell Williams. Mr. Blank received his J.D. cum laude from the University of Michigan Law School, and in an earlier career was a police officer with the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. Eric, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for that nice introduction.
Great. We're looking forward to shedding some new light on this hot topic. Could you start our listeners off today with a really brief overview of what the cloud is?
Well, so the cloud computing, also known as software as a service, and I will use those terms interchangeably, SaaS and cloud. What that means is third-party provided services. Usually we think of them as hosted via an internet connection. It's very similar to the sort of a return to the old days where there's a central computer that has the brains and information and terminals are connected to it, except these days those terminals might be in New York City where the users are and the data might be hosted in Kansas or in California. Normally also with respect to cloud computing, we think of dedicated data centers that are supporting a large number of user groups, and people pay into cloud computing on a subscription basis. So that's the kind of contractual relationship you have with these so-called cloud providers.
Great. I'm glad to have a common point of reference now. With that, can we jump into the real implications to our listeners who are concerned with the legal and technical challenges that we face, especially discovering data in the cloud?
Right. Well, I think the starting point that I like to begin with when talking about cloud computing, and I don't think this will come as a surprise to many listeners, is that, of course, the use of cloud computing is exploding. And so in e-discovery, you can't help but have cloud situations, even when just a few years ago, you wouldn't expect to have them. And there's a lot of data being hosted in the cloud. There's payroll data, timekeeping data, all kinds of inventory and client records. Email, of course, can be provided from the cloud or archived in the cloud. There are various database hosting activities in the cloud, and you see entire new groups of data management companies that subcontract out to outfits like Amazon, for example, for inexpensive data storage. Also, I think sometimes overlooked are all the telecommunications activities. A cell phone service is almost always provided in a cloud-type environment where users log in to check their cell phone records, and the records of text messages and phone calls and cell phone locations are all kept in the cloud at off-site database centers. They're not kept, of course, naturally. They're not kept at the user's location. And then there's all this corporate and marketing and networking, all these tools such as Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and the YouTube movies. Of course, websites, that would count as the cloud if they're hosted by a third party and not by the company itself. And then I think we just saw this very recently, the launch of Microsoft Office web apps for Microsoft Office 2010, which will compete directly with Google Apps. And Google Apps, which is online spreadsheeting, word processing, and presentations, Google says they've got 25 million users. Microsoft Office is installed in about 500 million computers around the United States and the world, and Microsoft is saying that they're expecting to get 10 to 15 million cloud users this year. So we'll also be getting word processing documents out of the cloud. So all of that means that we're going to have the same challenges in e-discovery with respect to cloud computing that we have with e-discovery with regular computing. But cloud raises certain specific issues that are of concern, and we've already seen those starting to rear their heads. I'm going to just run down a list of what I think are the nine primary concerns with cloud computing, both from an e-discovery standpoint and just a legal use standpoint. Number one, of course, access, and I'll go through these in more detail, but I'm just going to run down the list. Access, identification, preservation, and extraction issues, custody and control, who controls these records, privacy, the legal and regulatory requirements. Really what I mean, there's conflict of laws issue when the data is hosted in one place and the user's in another place. By places, I mean legal jurisdictions. The issues of metadata and what we would call metadata bleed over. The other issue of too much data for too long. And then I think the ninth issue were the necessity to have certain sections in any contract that involves cloud computing, which you wouldn't necessarily have in other kinds of contracts. So I think I will, if you're thinking it's the right thing to do, Tom, I'm just going to run through those nine items one after another and give a little bit of an overview of the central issues that that I think they address.
Sounds like there is a lot to. It sounds like there is a lot to think about, especially since it sounds like this is upon us and not some enigma in the future.
Right. It's interesting. We work on a lot of e-discovery projects involving cloud computing, and if I were to graph how much in 2010 we're seeing versus 29 versus 2008, 2007, it's a very steep curve, and especially pieces of e-discovery that all the parties want to get in many, many kinds of lawsuits, especially lawsuits between businesses, such as the financial records, accounting records. Those can now be kept in the cloud, and you have to go after them. So the first concern that I raised is the issue of access. This is probably the number one concern from an e-discovery standpoint, both as an offensive tool and as a defensive tool, because if you represent a company that has data in the cloud, and the company's in litigation, in the normal sense, that is the company's data, you would think of it that way, and in the normal discovery process, the company would receive a request for production of documents. They would review these documents, including the documents in the cloud. After reviewing them for relevancy and privilege, they'd turn the documents over to the other side if they were responsive to discovery requests. The issue with cloud computing is there is nothing right now other than just sheer outrage and the fact that it causes a lot of ruckus in lawsuits, there's nothing to prevent a party from subpoenaing that information directly from the cloud service provider. So if a company has all of its financial and accounting records in the hands of a third party, that third party may receive a subpoena and turn the data over directly to the requesting party. And that, I've seen both sides of that issue and frankly have argued both sides of it, but certainly it's fair to say that what that does is it circumvents the normal discovery process. I think it's most similar to the way that if litigation involving municipalities and governments, they will often receive both discovery requests that are formal discovery requests, and they'll receive through a different channel a Freedom of Information Act or what in Washington is called the Public Disclosure Act. They'll receive requests that way. As a practical matter for people who are used to working in the discovery trenches, that means you've got two different channels of discovery. There's somebody in charge of Freedom of Information, and there's somebody in charge of the legal response. And they may be completely different people that don't talk to each other, and just in the normal process of the way the world works, they're going to turn over different documents. It happens all the time in government lawsuits, and the expectation here is that something similar will happen when the cloud provider receives subpoenas. And we've already seen that happening both with respect to word processing documents and also with respect to email. For example, not to pick on Google because I'll probably mention them a couple of other times, but for example, Google will host a domain. They will host a company's website and replace, say, an Exchange server for email. That means Google has all the company's email. And they may also, Google also offers archiving services, so they may also be archiving that email. Google doesn't have a function set up to spend money or to bill their customers. These are, you know, it's $50 a year per user to have this service provided. So there's no money in the pipe for Google to pay to defend subpoenas not directed against them, except to the extent they're a third party. So what you see with Gmail and also with Microsoft's Hotmail and with Yahoo Mail and with AOL Mail is that those companies normally notify their users that they received a subpoena, and there should be other notification channels as well, but they turn this data over to the requesting party. And it's managing how that is going to work is going to be a very serious concern in e-discovery, and it's something to think about if you're the person asking the questions, and it's also something to think about if you're the person receiving the request for production. So access, that's what I mean by access, and we're going to see a lot of buzz on that in the next 3 years.
So Eric, I'm thinking that the average person that just heard this and their company is involved in litigation is going to say, well, the answer is simple. I'm never going there. Can they avoid it?
You mean can they avoid going to cloud computing?
That's right.
No. I think the best example of how they can't avoid it is we are seeing Microsoft entering the cloud space and very seriously for the first time with Office 2010, and that is a recognition of what many observers would already state, which is the future has got to be cloud computing. It's just too efficient. Everyone has too many devices they carry around with them. They want to work from home. They want to work from the road. They want the devices to integrate. They want to be able to share documents. They don't want to be chained to a desktop computer. And desktop computers are expensive. You have to replace them every few years. The devices that connect to the Internet can be very simple. They can be what we call thin clients, that is very, very, very inexpensive, simple computers and telephones and everything else that can connect to the Internet. So the future is the cloud. We're not going to avoid it.
So then we do have to figure out how to deal with it.
Right, that's right. So a second issue is this identification or assessment. And, you know, in e-discovery these days, everyone talks about the first challenge when you start the e-discovery process being what we now call early case assessment, or, you know, ECA. So early case assessment is when you go out and figure out what your client has in terms of the electronic documents so you can get some sense of what's going to be required to do to undertake the obligations to preserve and extract data. With respect to a cloud computing system, when the third-party service provider is managing the data, how do you do early case assessment? And we've seen, you know, from Zubelake to the new pension fund case, we've seen these cases saying it is negligence to not undertake litigation hold and to fail to undertake early case assessment, maybe even gross negligence. How do you do that with respect to a cloud computing company that may be many, many times bigger than your client or many, many times smaller than your client? What are they doing with the data? How long are they holding it? What steps can they take to preserve it? What's a sensible approach to extraction? Your client won't know the answers to any of these questions in the normal sense because they don't control the cloud provider's IT infrastructure. So that's a concern that I think can be addressed by a contract so that there's no argument when a case happens, but it's certainly a concern. And for the work that we've done, it's always problematic because you don't know what the third-party payroll service or whatever, you don't know how they treat their documents. So, and I guess I would say the final point of that is that part of e-discovery means we need to work quickly and early on in the case in a way we never had to in the paper world. That means we need to already know the answers to some of these questions on the cloud computing side because it's just too slow to try to figure it out after litigation has started. So that means you're putting together the litigation hold process, you're doing early case assessment, you need to have done all this work ahead of time or else it'll be very, very expensive. All right, so the next thing I talk about is then preservation and extraction, which again, on the e-discovery side, we understand what that means. Sometimes you're just going to set a computer to the side because it doesn't need to be kept in service. It has potentially responsive documents. You just set it aside. Other times, if a server is being kept in service, or you want to keep the mailboxes in service, or you have a desktop you want to keep in service, then you might copy off some of the files. And still other times you might make actual images of the files in order to undertake forensic searches. Well, with the third party, you have the same problem that you had with identification and assessment. What do you preserve? What do you extract? You're looking at a big server farm that might have literally hundreds, probably mostly virtualized these days, but hundreds of servers that have your data, but your data scattered across all of them. It is an enormous undertaking to try to preserve and extract that data, and it requires the cooperation of the cloud provider. If these questions weren't addressed at the contracting stage, neither party may be in a position to do what the court is going to expect them to do with respect to preservation and extraction, because it's expensive. Who's going to pay for it? Is it part of the service that the cloud provider provides? Or is it part of the, is an additional special service that has to be paid for by the customer?
And Eric, can you clarify what isn't there anymore? You mentioned a thin client earlier, and now you mention users storing documents virtually. When you put that together and compare it to the cases where attorneys would engage forensic experts to capture a machine to do everything possible to preserve its content, including deleted, unallocated, or slack space, how does that stack up to a thin client where that might not exist on a local machine? Do you still have that information?
I think the interesting forensic information to get off the local machine will be data transfer activity, which is very important in employment-type cases. Have employees move data immediately prior to their departure. You still see that kind of information because, you know, forensically you see that. You'll also see fragments sort of similar to temp caches, temporary internet caches, because the pages being looked at in the cloud will often be temporary. I personally think that we are moving away from doing as much forensic work. I mean, there are definitely cases where forensic work matters, but I think there was a period where the thinking was, okay, the lawsuit has started, we're going to take forensic images of, you know, every computer in a 2,000-foot radius. I think we've moved away from that anyway. So I think the bigger problem is going to be that if you want to take any of the normal forensic work that we used to have, such as what did this document look like before you changed it, that almost certainly won't be available. And that'll be lost in the cloud somewhere. And the expense of trying to go into the cloud center and pull up unless it's saved through some process, to forensically track down and find a prior version of a document, I think that's going to be cost prohibitive in all but the tiny, tiny fraction of cases. I also think we're going to solid state computing anyway, so as we've already, you know, in my practice, we're already seeing some of these solid state hard drives, and, you know, they are essentially immune to forensic inquiry.
And P.S., what cloud company is going to let a company come attach to the server?
That's a very good point. I've done a couple of these, like, image the whole warehouse jobs, and it's, you know, it's insanity. It's very, very expensive. It does happen. Sometimes it's justified in happening, but it's millions of dollars. And if you came to a cloud computing facility and said, okay, I need to forensically address all of my files, they'd say, well, okay, they're scattered across this double warehouse complex of servers. What are you going to image? You're going to image 10,000 hard drives? I think that's a very good point. All right, so I think I'd like to go to the next point, which is the point of this custody and control and forensics. We've talked a little bit about forensics a little. I think we would be remiss not to at least mention the issue of custody. Now, control, of course, is extremely important because of this whole issue of, for many reasons, but one of them being having control of turning over documents. And I just can't emphasize enough that it's not that people are trying to not turn over documents they should turn over. It's that control of the documents and the ability to review them in a controlled environment and to turn them over in a measured way that's appropriate under the circumstances and in response to requests for production and other legitimate discovery requests. That's an important part of our civil litigation process. One of the things we've seen with e-discovery is there's a lot, and I'm a part of the problem. We see in e-discovery a lot of grabbing the entire computer. What rule of civil procedure allows you to take the whole computer in a lawsuit? When is it everything on that computer going to be relevant or material to the case? That's not how our discovery process normally works. And I think we've gotten away from that a little bit when we go in on these seizure raids and we grab every single computer. I understand the arguments for that because I've made them myself, but I think that I think that the central issue is that control is extremely important in order for the civil litigation process as we know it to continue, and also to reduce the number of documents that we're reviewing. That's the expense of reviewing documents. Custody, I think we always talk about chain of custody being something we need to be concerned about in e-discovery, because how do you know where this document came from? How do you know it wasn't tampered with? Does it have a good chain of custody in a way that we'd expect from, say, a criminal chain of custody? Well, in reality, chain of custody is rarely a concern. Authentication of documents that actually make it to trial is almost never an issue. So I think we need to mention custody. I think that there are some basic steps that cloud computing systems can do to establish that they have appropriate custodial control of these documents. You know, but these are physical and virtual security processes that we'd expect just as a matter of good business practice. So I think custody, although it's a concern and needs to be raised, is not going to be a huge issue. On the other hand, I think
It seems, Eric, like it empowers the company over the employee, thereby benefiting a response to litigation. Wouldn't the company have more control of its documents than in the cloud versus the traditional litigation today, where you may have individually controlled documents dispersed throughout an organization?
Well, I think that's a good point. If there are good tracking mechanisms as to who has access to which documents, and if you have custodial records where you can show this document has been accessed 15 times by these different usernames, I think that's a very good point. I think because word processing type documents are really the final group to enter the cloud, maybe I'm just not as concerned about this as I should be, because we haven't seen a lot of cases about tampering with word processing documents in the cloud. But maybe that's just because there haven't been that many documents in the cloud. Because, you know, with respect to email and payroll records and, you know, the kinds of things that people do pull out of the cloud, it's hard to tamper with them because they have so many multiple redundancies. It would take an enormous effort. All right, but the privacy, the next issue, I think, should be the top of mind for everybody. And now this is a little bit about e-discovery, and I mostly work in the civil context, but I work a little bit on the criminal side, and the government's ability to, well, I should say that I would include on the civil side regulatory inquiries by government or quasi-governmental agencies like FINRA and the FCC, and the state-by-state financial institution organizations. Privacy and access to the documents and access to the data and the data paths, we see it with this recent brouhaha over Facebook, which frankly shouldn't really surprise everyone, but seems to have surprised people that the entries people make on Facebook are recorded and acted upon. We're certainly going to see targeted advertising based on user entries. And as far as government access to these records held by cloud providers, we already have some ability for the government to get these records without any kind of formal action whatsoever. We also, as a practical matter, the big cloud providers, and here I mean again, you know, Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, and to a lesser extent these days AOL, they want to cooperate with law enforcement. They need the help of law enforcement for their anti-piracy work and for their other anti-infringement actions. They want to be cooperative, and they do cooperate. The cell phone providers are the same way. They are very cooperative in turning over private text messages to law enforcement, sometimes with a warrant and sometimes with a subpoena and sometimes not with either of those. So one way to see the seriousness of this privacy issue is to look up the Digital Due Process Coalition, which is a joint initiative by Microsoft and by Google, to come together to ask for better privacy laws to protect user data. And the essence of this argument is very easy. As an individual, you would expect data within your wingspan, as we used to say in the policing, to be your private data, that you have an expectation of privacy, and that to come and seize that information would require some kind of search warrant. The cloud computing system on which you keep your private life records, or which companies keep their private records, is not within your wingspan. It's in the hands of a third party who's been entrusted with the information, and the government can go and ask for this information to be turned over, and they're going to get a level of cooperation that you wouldn't expect on the civil side. So the Digital Due Process Coalition, it lays out, I think, pretty well the argument that Google and Microsoft have that this is a huge problem. And we have this ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and also the Stored Communications Act, which for those of you who have tried to get Hotmail messages, you'll often see a pushback from the corporation saying you can't get content of messages because they're protected by ECPA. Well, the Stored Communications Act for non-email messages like your Word documents you're now going to be keeping in the cloud, that specifically lays out an exception to data that's older than 180 days. The reason for that was that the way email used to work was that people would download to their computers email messages. And when they were downloaded, they left the server because storage limitations were an issue. They left the server and went to the desktop, and then they were on the desktop, and the usual privacy protections would apply once those emails were on the desktop. Emails that weren't downloaded from the server for more than 180 days were considered abandoned, like garbage, and so they have no privacy protection. That's still the current state of the law today. And so if you're keeping your email in the cloud, email that's older than 180 days is abandoned as far as the law against unreasonable seizures is concerned. So that needs to be addressed in the cloud, both in contract, and probably we'll get some laws on that too. And it affects the e-discovery approach, because sometimes you got to split on the sort of the aggressor side. You've got to squeeze these providers a little bit, and they'll often talk about ECPA and the SCA, and this is one way to sort of remind them that they don't have those protections. I think it's also interesting to point out that you don't see that issue being raised very much, I think on purpose, because it's pretty scary for everyone, especially for companies.
So you're saying if I leave my data there too long, it's free, right? Free game.
Right. Now, as a practical matter, if I were to call up, you use, let's say, Google Apps, and I call up Google and say, hey, I want all of Tom's data that's older than 180 days, I hope that Google will say to me, get lost. But so I don't think it's just hanging out there for anyone to grab. But if the government comes along and wants it, and the government here being a regulatory agency, which, as we know, again, same control issue, there are many financial institutions and healthcare institutions that are continuously evaluated by regulators, they would not be happy to know that their data can be turned over so easily in the event of a government request. So that leads to two other, or maybe three other, concerns related to how the cloud providers store and manage this information. One is, and we've seen this with respect to European Union privacy laws, one is if you are a company in France and you want you're storing data and the data is being stored in the United States, the privacy protections in the United States are, as I've just discussed, less robust than in the European Union, where you're required to protect what they consider to be private data. So you have some conflict of laws issues, and you can fall afoul of this process in the where this plays into electronic discovery issues is that if you're in litigation in, for example, Europe, and you go ahead and bring document requests in the United States and request data that you're not allowed to have access to this way in Europe, you can get in trouble in Europe. And we've seen that happen in both France and Germany with respect to both Yahoo and Google. So it's state by state in the United States, we're pretty much even. There are some, you know, especially Massachusetts, these new privacy laws, but the bigger concern is if you're working in any kind of international dispute, just because it's easier to come to the U.S. to get the data. If the litigation is in Europe, it can be extremely problematic, and the cloud host is not going to care. They don't know. They're hosting the data in the United States. So the second is this issue of metadata. You know, metadata being what everyone hates to hear being called the data about the data, but the creation date, last access date, modification date, and so forth and so on that I was just, that we call metadata. This data in a Windows type, in a Microsoft Windows environment, is an actual additional document that just doesn't have a suffix, doesn't have a dot anything. This is not dot doc or any of that stuff. It's got nothing. So it's not visible without forensic tools except for what the underlying application chooses to show you. But if you use a product like NCASE or Access Data's Forensic Toolkit, you can see that just about every document that's out there has at least 100 different types of metadata associated with it. Also, in the Windows environment, we only have, for example, one last access date, one last written, you know, last written date, one modification date, one creation date. We were talking earlier about how a cloud service for security purposes could keep track of every modification date and every access date. Well, this can, if all this data is out there, maybe that's good. But from an e-discovery standpoint, if you're trying to manage the cost of e-discovery, I think it's important to know going in what kind of data is the cloud service going to keep about your documents. And if you're the one requesting discovery, there's no reason you can't ask for the same data. It doesn't take any forensic inquiry to print off a report of last access dates and modification dates if that's important in your case. So there is more data and more data in e-discovery. Sometimes it's good for you. Sometimes it's bad for you. But all times, it's more expensive. And so sort of cracking down on what the cloud organizations are keeping and why they're keeping it, I think, is important to think about when in the e-discovery concept. And also, if you're engaging in e-discovery, think about this as another source of information for your case. That's the metadata bleed over issue.
So how do we wrap this all together, Eric? What would you say are the important takeaways?
Well, I would think that make a list of what to put in contracts with cloud computing companies. And with some of these companies, there's just not a lot of negotiating power unless you yourself are working for a very large corporation. But nevertheless, exercise caution and have, I would say, the following contract essentials. Have some kind of notification requirements. What happens if the cloud computing provider receives a request for information, a warrant, a subpoena, whatever? Mandate. You know, we see these notifications happening on the web mail, but those are pretty much voluntary, just developed over the years. Mandate this in your contract that you must be notified. Secondly, decide on the right level of security and how much data is going to be kept about that security, and have that in the contract too. Understand this data retention. How long is the data kept? Because the cloud provider may be keeping the data forever because it's cheaper just to add storage, because storage is so cheap, than to try to sort data out. So bracket your data retention scope and dates so that you don't find out when the lawsuit starts that you've got way too much data. Understand who's going to pay for e-discovery. Who's going to pay for that process of searching and recovering and putting out records, and how much is it going to cost? Understand that at the contract level. Get some insurance. Both the cloud provider needs to show proof of insurance. You'd expect these big companies to have insurance, and sometimes you'd be surprised. The truth is that it's very difficult to prove damages when anything goes wrong with your data, because it's hard to prove damages from the loss of some Word documents. So insurance is an important part of any contract, and the cloud contracts I've seen is the the insurance requirements are just not there, and I'm always surprised at that. And also, and finally, have some essential service level agreement points about access and security and uptime and turnaround time and so forth. Without a service level agreement, you may find you've got a request for production coming in where you've got 30 days and you don't feel like crawling over and asking for an extension because you don't want to give up the leverage, but your cloud provider says that their normal turnaround time is 180 days. We've seen that already with respect to internet mail, and again, that should be addressed at the contract stage. So with some of these contract essentials and with an eye towards what's really out there in the cloud and the kind of information that we're seeing being moved into the cloud, I think we can all sort of enter the cloud world thinking, well, there's still going to be a lot of e-discovery, and what we're really looking at is issues of access and cost.
And you've clearly given our e-discovery professionals a good list of questions to start to ask their client IT people about as well. So I'm sure this is going to be worth a good listen to all those out there. Eric, thanks again for your time today. This has been tremendously informative.
Please stay tuned to the ILTA website for ongoing podcasts about this topic and other topics of interest to the litigation support peer group. Thank you for your time today. We look forward to you visiting again. Until then, this is Tom Barse with Eric Blank, wishing you all the best in all you do. Thank you.